Star Trek 57, M23, take two.
It's got Star Trek, episode 21, TNG season 7, Thine Own Self.
Stranded without his memory on a primitive planet.
I do not know my name.
Data brings death to an entire village.
Father, what's wrong?
Now he must race to find a cure.
It's his fault. None of us were sick before he came to the village.
Before an angry mob targets him for revenge.
There he is!
I only wish to help.
By bringing this plague?
Next time on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Wait. Did anyone see what?
Ernest Goes to Camp?
Very long ago.
It was a teleplay by Ronald D. Moore. No, it wasn't. It was, There was these two chef, bumbling chef guys. They were the cooks. They were the camp guy cooks. And they
those guys wrote the movie?
No. But they said one of them was like modeling clay, the secret ingredient to eggs erroneous. Because they were trying to like find out like they're trying to figure out how to make eggs erroneous, and they were trying to find the secret ingredient. It was like their whole mission was to figure out how to make eggs erroneous. We never found out if they did or not.
What's eggs erroneous?
I don't know. It's some kind of dish they were trying to make.
I thought it might be a skin condition.
Ernest goes to jail.
I think it was a food. I can only think that it's related to eggs. Ernest didn't go to jail until two movies later.
It was a couple movies, yeah.
He saved Christmas in between.
Ernest saves Christmas, yeah.
Then there was Ernest Goes to Africa.
That was the problematic one, as I recall.
I thought that was after the Ernest Goes to Jail.
Yeah, it was.
Wasn't that the last one?
There's Ernest Rides Again, I think.
Well, so after Ernest Goes to Jail, there was Ernest Scared Stupid, which was Halloween
Ernest
one.
Ernest Scared Stupid, that's right.
And then somewhere in there was the one where he was Ernest Rides Again, where he's like on some log or something,
yeah,
riding down a hill or something for the whole movie. I don't know. And then I'm assuming Ernest Goes to Africa was the last one, because that seems like that would be the last one.
Yeah, they were like, okay, no more of these.
But there's got to be another one in there. I don't know of any other one.
Wasn't he in Beverly Hillbillies reboot?
Yeah, he was. I don't know if there are any more Ernest movies, though. I know there was, I used to rent this video with my brother, which was a bunch of ads where Ernest P. Worrell was a character before the movies. He was in ads.
He would go around and do ads, yeah.
Yeah.
And there's like all over the place, and he would read things and the Ernest accent, he would read them in his like sort of like straight guy accent.
And that's the one where he would talk to Vern all the time.
Yeah.
See, he didn't talk to Vern until Ernest Saves Christmas. He didn't talk to Vern in Ernest Goes
to
Camp.
He was talking to the camera like it was Vern.
Yeah. And then Ernest, so there was video you could rent at Errol's Video or whatever of like a compilation of all the commercials that he was doing. I'm sure there was some outtakes and stuff too. So
Ernest Goes to Africa. By the way, welcome to It's Got Ernest.
It's Got Ernest.
Ernest Goes to Africa was 1997,
uh-huh.
Direct-to-video,
oh.
And Ernest unknowingly comes into the possession of some stolen jewels and is kidnapped and brought to Africa, where he must rescue the woman he loves.
Okay, well, sounds wholesome. Some jewels? Do you think they were blood diamonds?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, it's a question we could conceivably find out by continuing to read.
We have to figure out which part of Africa he goes to.
He goes to, well, it's filmed in Johannesburg.
Okay. Well,
South Africa. So.
It could be some diamonds down, blood diamonds.
Say South Africa?
I don't know how to do a South African accent.
I don't either.
There's that fellow who's that South African actor who was in District 9.
Yahoo Serious?
Are you serious?
No.
Are you serious? Didn't Yahoo Serious have some sort of tragic life?
I don't know. It's tragic we don't see him anymore.
Welcome to It's Got Non-American White Actors.
Yeah, that District 9 actor, I know who you're talking about. He had a mustache in that movie. Oh, man, last week, when I was talking about the location of Star Trek VI, I was like saying it was like Chugach or something.
Yeah.
Or whatever. And then I listened back, and I said Valdez. And it's like, I was like, it's not Valdez. It's
Valdez?
It's Valdez.
Oh, Valdez?
It's Valdez.
Now, is it spelled Valdez?
It's spelled Valdez.
But it's pronounced Valdez.
I'm almost positive.
Are you sure that's just not a...
Isn't Valdez pronounced Valdez?
I remember because there was the Alaskan oil spill in like, was it 91 or something?
Yeah, the Exxon Valdez.
It was the Valdez.
Valdez.
It's not. You're saying
Are you setting up a D's nuts joke?
No. I wish I had been.
I was
about to go for it. If you guys are going to keep going.
Oh, I foiled you.
No, it was. So you were trying to set up one.
I wasn't. He was.
I'm always trying to set up one.
That's a fair point. That is a fair point. Speaking of last week, our good old friend Tarek wrote in on Twitter at itsgotstartrek.com, and he said, we remember we were forgetting you in your racist quiz element at the end. We were talking about Star Trek VI.
The undiscovered country. The discovered racism or whatever I called that.
Yeah, game. And there was the quotes from the racist crew members, and we couldn't remember their names.
That's right.
Just that they were funny names. He said he believed they were Burke and Samno. Which I believe Samno. Is correct. Yes,
like those are racist names.
Yeah, there's Burke. Some like. It does sound kind of racist, right? So, thank you, Tarek, for letting us know the actual names of those racist killers.
So, yeah, thank you, Tarek. That was good because I only had crewman one and crewman two, which, you know, I should have tried harder. But
he said he remembered from the novelization.
Okay, yeah, I wouldn't have gotten that. That's pretty. That's deep, man.
Yeah, and now I'm kind of digging. I want to read the novelization.
That's
now.
That's a deep cut. I'm looking at Valdez. It's on thealaskalife.com. Alaska names you probably mispronounced 15 of them. Number four is Val. what was thought, so I said? It's Valdez. In parentheses, they spell the pronunciation, and they spell it Valdez. Valdez.
Deez. Nuts.
Exactly.
Valdez nuts.
Exactly. So
cool. All right. So that concludes the initial segment of the show.
Calvin wanted to go to the Yukon,
where we do heavily scripted, inane chatter. We are now moving along to the discussion of the Star Trek episode portion of the show.
Right. We should probably put this at the end, right?
No, this should go at the this is at the beginning.
Right, this is at the beginning. It's just I don't know if people will be annoyed that we didn't get right into the...
I have no doubt they will be. Okay. But, you know, aggravation is an important part of art.
We're educating here. Yeah. We're teaching you have to discipline.
Maybe some people have never heard of Ernest P. Worrell.
Maybe not. That's possible. That's why they came to a Star Trek.
Barney or
Star Trek podcast. Well, we're like a Taekwondo instructor, right? We're teaching discipline. Nobody bothers me.
Nobody bothers me.
Was that Taekwondo?
It was Jun Ri, yeah.
Jun Ri, Taekwondo.
Might for right.
Yeah. All right, so this week we're talking about Thine Own Self, the 16th episode of the 7th season of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Unlike Ernest Goes to Camp, this teleplay was by Ronald D. Moore.
Ah, good. It's a very tightly written story, I think. I agree. As a brief summary, Data gets a little case of the old amnesia. And ends up in a medieval town where a number of sort of alien people, some are nice to him and some are not so nice to him.
He got amnesia because he was downloading some stuff from the probes logs.
He was
downloading probes logs, and there was a surge that overloaded his positronic matrix, and he selectively forgot a few things, so...
Yeah, what are you gonna do? It happens.
Yeah, it happens. I thought it was good. Yeah, it was a good tightly.
What you gonna do when your positronic matrix gets overloaded? What you gonna do?
What you gonna do with
the? But you know, I like this episode because it's a classic, very classic Star Trek story. It's got the A story and the B story, right? And I figure the Data story is the meat of the bones, meat on the bones part of the story. But let's touch base that's the A story, right? The B story is the whole Counselor Troi deciding that she wants to take the the bridge officer's test.
Is there any kind of rule that A and B plots should generally follow a theme of the episode? Because I think that these did follow a theme, and that general theme being kind of sort of feeling fear and anger that results from sort of ignorance, or maybe more nicely put, a lack of understanding. Both Troi felt some kind... She, at one point near the end when she was really having trouble, she felt a lot of frustration and fear and anger... Because she was approaching it all from the sort of the wrong perspective.
And yeah.
So, no, I think it was. Honestly,
I think you've done an amazing job finding a connection between these two. Because it makes sense.
I wasn't even looking. I'm not going to look too deeply into something that I don't think is there just for the sake of connecting dots.
I am complimenting you.
I think
on discovering that that connection.
I think
because I did not see
I think
that.
He's talking down
well,
to me.
I'm
not.
I think you are onto something because if the title is Thine Own Self and it's like to thine own self
yeah.
be true, and that more or less means to simplify it to do the right thing. Troy ended up doing the right thing in the end to pass the test.
She did. So to thine own self, she was spending all her time feeling insecure about her technical knowledge. That was one of the aspects. She kind of expressed that at the end. It was kind of like, I may not know all this technical stuff. I've been studying these books. So she spent so much time being insecure about that, that she didn't even realize that that's not the issue.
Right. It wasn't. She's not the engineer. She just has to make the decision.
So yeah, someone like an engineer who would have more confidence in that area, they would sooner realize that they need to sort of like think of like the unthinkable alternative. Being like to have that confidence when you have a subject that you're confident on your knowledge about to be able to say, this is not going to work in the way that, like, I want to be able to handle this. We need to think of a different sort of action. And so
I do feel like a moron because, like, I've seen this episode a million times. And I honestly always thought, I was like, man, this Troy story is, like, very abridged and completely unrelated to the Data story. But you've made a much stronger connection. I still don't think it's a mega strong connection, but I do think it's one that I certainly didn't perceive there before.
It's sort of funny that so Troy hasn't. She just hasn't taken the right tests to be a, you know, a official bridge officer. However, for the entire show, she has been on the bridge, you know, because of her diplomatic skills. She's an officer. She's on the bridge.
She was
the highest ranking officer on the bridge at one point, and she was by default the captain of the ship, but she still wasn't officially a bridge officer yet.
Yeah, they had a special seat to the left of the captain just for her.
She sat there the whole damn time.
Yeah, what rank is supposed to go there? I don't know. I think we've had this discussion.
She's a lieutenant commander.
I think in the technical manual it says that's like the extra seat for guests.
So she's the permanent guest. She's like the Andy Richter or the...
I did like that this story...
Ed McMahon.
Yeah. I like that the Troy story stemmed from a couple seasons before in that episode Disaster,
right,
where they hit that quantum filament and everything goes to shit.
Yeah,
and that's a really great episode, you know, where they have these three, you know, few different groups of people all having to solve problems. And they actually kind of have to do the ant thing where they're actually solving the same problem, but they don't necessarily have communication. So they've got to like figure out what their role in fixing things is. But that was a good episode, and it's cool that this didn't come out of nowhere, right? Mm-hmm. That this came from that episode, that we saw the seeds of it there. There is a legitimate, you know, canon storytelling reason why all of a sudden Troy would decide to do this beyond just going to her class reunion. But the other thing I like that they put in here that I really didn't catch before is that, you know, Beverly Crusher is, you know, sitting there and she's got the Night Watch and she's in command, and that, and Troy has that conversation with her about that. Why did she choose to do that, et cetera. And it's a great little conversation, but it also serves in this seventh season, towards the end of the seventh season, it sets up the idea of Beverly being on the command track. And of course, in All Good Things in the future, she's a captain of the USS Pasteur, right? So like they did a lot of subtle stuff in the particularly in the last few seasons that they didn't do before in terms of layering clues and stuff and building story elements over multiple episodes, not serialized, but moving in that direction.
Well, so, and you just mentioned that, you know, this is kind of the seeds of Crusher moving in that direction. She talked about she had the commander rank, and I don't know if I can't remember if they mentioned whether or not when she had it.
I think she always had that.
She always had it. Now, is this some kind of, was she ever referred, I can't remember if she was ever referred to as, well, not that I can't remember, I just don't know, if she was ever referred to as commander in early episodes of TNG, and maybe they did this to try to sort of like explain that away, or if they just never mentioned it and that was just an idea they had to just make her a commander, you know.
Well,
either way, I mean, it's cool.
It's like she's like technically a commander, but she's like the doctor, like she holds the rank of commander. She's never like she's never supposed to be in a command position.
And
exactly.
I'm wondering, and I'm going to be on the lookout now, if TNG ever mentions that rank in prior episodes.
I have no specific recollection. Yeah, it may be one. You know how sometimes when they're captured prisoner or something, they read out their information. It might have been on something like that.
Could have been, yeah.
Yeah. But it is, you know, the character of Troy is very interesting, right? Lots of different opinions on her. I generally like her, but I also understand that there are some legitimate criticisms to sort of some directions the character went here and there. Some people don't like Loxana Troy, for example, and so a lot of Troy episodes can include that. However, this really was a really great story of somebody where you could see how their career is as a psychotherapist, and they're into emotion and that sort of thing. And you could see where it is a bad fit on the surface. That's like the surface view of like, why people ask her, why would you want to do that? Why would you want to be in that position? But she knows that it's a silly criticism, right? It's like, of course I have the capability. In fact, the tools I have could be very useful in a command situation. That's what she perceives. And I think correctly so.
And she's been on the bridge this whole fucking time.
Well, that's true. She's learned from some of the best, right?
She knows what's going on. She's looking out the window with everybody else.
So when the episode, back to the B plot, it was the scene where Riker was playing his bone.
Oh yeah, that was great.
Because we know
that kicked ass.
Riker was like, "This is a better way for you to communicate."
Yeah, yeah.
And he was like, "Wah,
wah." Riker the hot boner. First of all, I was wondering how the soundproofing is in that those.
Yeah,
I bet it's great.
It's got to be great.
You know what I was wondering? I was wondering if Riker has some gas. Like, I was like, is he just like straight up just chilling and like jazzing out just by himself, just having a good old time in his sexy pajamas? He's just like, I'm just going to play some bone tonight. Or does he have some sort of computer program that tracks all the women in the Enterprise? And when they're like near his thing, he's just all starts tooting on and be like, yeah. He just like jumps out of his fucking bed and he's like, all right, there's one.
Yeah, because it seems like, I mean, the trombone, as a trombone player, I can say the trombone is fucking awesome, right? But is it really one of the sexier instruments?
It's not like it's a saxophone.
Yeah, right. But Riker somehow pulls it off.
And he looked
he pulls off the bone.
Absolutely. He looked like he was flirting with somebody before anyone was in the room with him.
He was flirting with that trombone is what he was.
Yeah. Or another possibility, he was playing trombone to some sexy little ensign girl that he had in there. And then when Troy came in, the girl is like hiding in the bathroom. We never see.
Yeah.
Because we like never see the bathroom.
Those are like the cut scenes. Like in Undiscovered Country when they cut out the part where he was like, that's not Klingon blood and it's a whole new story introduced.
Yeah.
They cut out the beginning and end scene. I'm sure they did that.
Yeah, dude.
One thing I was also impressed with Jonathan Frakes, is he, I can't remember if he
I think he's a real trombone player.
He's a real trombone player because this is one of the few times where it actually looks like he's playing the instrument. Because every time someone plays an instrument, invariably,
he's usually been pretty good with that.
Whatever instrument is, like if it's a flute or whatever, the fingering's all off, or the guitar.
Or a piano especially, you see people just going like, just wiggling fingers down there somewhere.
Right, exactly.
I'm going up here, I'm going down here, I'm going up here.
The only time it ever is accurate is when it's like a shot of just the hands, and you can tell it's like someone else's. So I was impressed by that. Yeah, his four different things he plays. He was playing two. These are according to closed captioning. He was playing two short questioning notes at first, right?
Questioning notes?
That was his two short two questioning notes. And then Troy was saying something like, what did she say? She was like, is this are you how you normally talk? Are you something, whatever?
This is much better.
And he goes, playing. Oh, yeah, I'll tell you what he said in response to that after that. So he said, play affirmative notes after the questioning notes. Then when she said that, he was playing a thank you, which is not to be mistaken with like a. But then she was like, "I like." What was that? I like that noise. I want to know what that means in the trombone language. Mm. But then when she told him, when she talked shit to him,
he knows that one.
He was playing a sour note, so she finds the trombone very romantic. She enjoyed it. So.
That kicks ass about the closed captioning, because I would have never thought of that, and that's genius.
Yeah, yeah. And so
what a weird job to have.
What, to be a counselor?
No. No, to the closed captioning.
Oh,
to be a trombone
player.
Comical trombone things in sci-fi TV shows.
Yeah, it takes a certain amount of interpretation and subjectivity, I guess. So it was an interesting after that. So the scene begins with sort of like Riker's plan. He's in control and stuff. And then he gives her the control. He goes, I knew I could count on my... After she, like, talks some shit, now she has the control. He's like, I knew I could count on my Imzadi. I forget what Imzadi means.
It's just they're, like, going steady, but, like, kind of extra.
Yeah, so...
Or used to be.
And he's like, the ship's counselor to boost my self-image. So that's, like, Troy is used to being in a position of power over other people. As the counselor, that's sort of your job, is you're supposed to...
She knows all their secrets.
She knows everyone's secrets. She's telling them what to do or how, you know, basically, in so many words. Not exactly, obviously, but you know what I'm saying. You know what I'm saying. And so that's sort of, like, you have an edge on people like that. And so she's as a counselor, is in this position of power. And then that shifts immediately back to Riker being in power, though, because she asks him. Now he's going to be her counselor. He's and you know, test giver and like judge, test giver, judge, jury, executioner. And so now we see this point where Riker is sort of has the edge of power over Troy. And I don't think you really see that too much, even though Riker has implied power over everybody. The one-on-one relationship with him and Troy have mostly been, you know, pretty equal, with maybe her sort of having a little more control, even though we all know he's got ultimately has the most control of everybody in the whole show.
Well, and power is a difficult thing to define because...
I was trying to think of a better word.
You could... No, it's a good word. It's just that it's difficult because there's a nexus of overlapping power dynamics, because you're right that Riker has X amount of power as the executive officer of the ship, and these are Starfleet personnel under his command. So he therefore has a great deal of power over them from that perspective. But there are, of course, other relationship dynamics and practical realities that can oftentimes limit Riker's power depending on which crew person you're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of strength, for example, it's not like he's the strongest. You know, Data and Worf got him beat out easily. Mm-hmm. And Troy oftentimes has access to insights that he simply would not be able to. And vice versa, of course.
He's like the third strongest.
You think so? I don't know. I think Mr. Mott probably...
Maybe Mr. Mott's,
Mr. Got, Mott's got some strong-ass forearms from all that clipping.
Yeah, so... Yeah, that was the B plot, right? And so then there was this whole...
Was it just me, or did it seem to resolve kind of not only quickly but early, compared to most B plots? Because they usually kind of weave in and out and both dovetail right towards the end.
Yeah.
This, there was the Troy plot sort of was resolved, you know, a little over like half of the way through the episode. And then it comes back right at the end in a comical way.
Yeah. Yeah. The episode was interesting. Like, yeah, the B plot was, you know, I guess the B plot is often unrelated, like in terms of, you know, sort of, they don't intertwine.
Yeah, really. They don't have to be the same story.
Yeah, and they often don't intertwine like literally, like sort of, you know, the two A story and the B story don't hit each other like directly, implied or thematically or just directly, you know. So, but this seemed pretty removed, and it was just kind of
It was sort of weird that like it seemed like people there for some reason there weren't a lot of people around, like everybody was on leave, like even when Crusher was on the bridge, and it was like there hardly was anybody else on the fucking bridge.
Yeah,
Picard doesn't show up until the very end.
In the very end,
and he's got one line, and he says it, and he's standing there the whole time, and you're waiting for him to say more, and he's looking like he wants to say more, and he's just staring, and he doesn't know what to do because he got one line, and he said it, and that was it.
And it was weird that Picard wasn't in the episode.
He was doing a Christmas Carol on stage in London.
Is that what it was? Yeah. Okay, so the reason to put him in the episode, I was wondering if there's some contractual thing, or if it's just kind of so you can say that yes, he is.
I think he's in every episode of Star Trek: The Next Generation.
That's what I mean. It's like an attendance thing, like Cal Ripken Jr. or whatever. It's like so you can say he's been in every single episode. Probably recorded that like at the tail end of another episode or something before he left.
We see Geordi and Worf, but we only see them. They're only like simulations on the
holograms.
And Geordi got thrown under the bus.
So it's like everybody else is taking a break, or it's just this all just happens like overnight somewhere, and everybody's sleeping or something.
Geordi looks all sad. Geordi looks all sad when he's all like, "All right,
it's like I can do it.
Yeah,
I guess I'll go kill myself."
Yeah, that's got to be a bummer, right? You don't even get a chance to say like, "Okay, guys, well, it was nice knowing you." You're just kind of like, "Okay, I guess I'll see you in a bit," you know. But we all know. You're not going to see him ever again.
I bet Geordi can do it.
Geordi
would have volunteered to do it straight away.
Yeah.
He would have been like, this is the way to do it. And then Data would have been like, actually, no, just take my head off and kind of bowl it down there. It'll all sort itself out.
Yeah, the night shift thing. I often find myself, it's like, oh yeah, they of course have to have a night shift, you know? And it's not that I ever didn't know that, but it's one of those things I keep forgetting or something. It's like, yeah, night shift. Picard's not on the frickin' ship 24 hours a day.
But he's got to have time to, you know, play the flute and read and have a cup of tea.
It's an interesting thing, though, the idea of, so we know they have shifts, right? Including an overnight shift, what they refer to kind of that way. I think it's in Chain of Command where, you know, when Captain Jellicoe takes over, like one of his whole deals is he wants I think he wants to go from like, I forget if it's from three shifts to four shifts or whatever, but he wants to change the whole shift structure and it pisses off Riker and all that. Anyway, so we know they have shifts. That makes sense. What's a little bit more debatable is the idea of having sort of a day-night cycle on the ship. One argument is that actually sort of makes sense, even though some people will be quote-unquote serving at night, but there's some biological clock reason or whatever, to just the lighting or something. Fair point. On the other hand, you know, it's like a spaceship, and you'd kind of be like, why not just have, you know, three different shifts of people kind of, and they're just living at different times. So 10 forwards always open, you know, cafeteria. I mean, it's... I don't know. It's not like it's a big groundbreaking thought, but it was just like I was thinking about that.
Does Guinan have to sleep? Because like if you go to 10 forward, is Guinan always there? I mean, it depends on the season.
They have that other guy, that one guy who played poker with them that one time.
Right, yeah.
I forget what it was. It was an episode. He was a bartender in like one episode, and he sat down and played poker with him.
Wasn't that guy from the Lower Decks episode, the kind of young guy with the green...
Was he
green
from
outfit?
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember if he was from Lower Decks.
Yeah,
or not,
I think it was from Lower Decks.
But I think it was someone was he was he just sat down with the he was like talking to Riker like he was just another guy and someone else was who was oh that might have been the Lower yes yeah. I think that was the Lower Decks
because the other three were officers they were all, the other ones were all like they were officers you know he wasn't an officer he was commiserating with them but he was like I'm good I'm not like vying for a promotion like you guys
And the thing about maybe the night, they just time the shifts. The night shift is just the time when nothing's really scheduled to happen because they also, it's like, it takes this many hours to get to this location. Well, should we wait until the day shift when our A crew is on or do we just schedule it so our
what
A crew will be
on?
What
happens if you're popping along and there's a quantum filament or a crystalline fucking entity?
Shit. Well, crystalline entity. All bets are off, man. I mean,
you can just like vibrate that shit.
You better hope that shit happens during the day shift when we got
just
Picard.
beam some radio waves at it and just like fucking that tear that shit to pieces.
See, Picard would have found an alternate solution to that. Your C-listers would have would shaken
exactly,
that thing to bits.
Exactly.
So, but I'm speaking of thine own self. That was actually not speaking of thine own self. Speaking of Lower Decks, that was episode 15. Of this season.
The previous episode.
Right. Which was a great episode. Some have claimed it's like their favorite episode or whatever.
Yeah, it's a really interesting
really
episode.
Good. But that was also followed by Masks.
Oh, which, yes. Masks is a weird one.
Which, according to Empire Magazine, via Wikipedia.org, the episode has been described as incomprehensible, impenetrable, and incoherent. So I
watched it recently.
Next topic for a podcast.
Yeah,
I watched it. I you know, I didn't find it as obnoxious as I remembered, but it's a weaker thing. I think
two episodes later we have Genesis where Barclay turns into a spider.
No, fuck that shit. Fuck that shit. I want to watch that soon. I actually haven't watched that in a very long time because I tended to skip it, and I feel bad about skipping it.
So
it scares me. I don't like seeing like Troy as a fish lady.
Yeah, it feels like a season one episode or something. But
Riker, doesn't Riker become like a Cro-Magnon man or something?
Does he? They all become
something like that.
Fucking ridiculous. But yeah, so season seven is hit or miss.
Season seven is up or down, but they do have some classics.
This is a good fun episode.
Well, and then I guess we can, you know, transition to the Data part of the episode because the Troy part's fun and there's some character building. I'm still a little curious as to why she was like, yeah, I haven't kept in touch with a lot of my classmates. Because it seems like all the rest of the Starfleet people, like, they know all their fucking classmates, even the ones they hated. They know exactly what they're doing and they're like calling them up and like teasing each other and shit.
Yeah.
She doesn't want to listen to like what they're thinking all the time. She already knows what they're thinking.
Oh, yeah.
That's a good,
they were were like thinking about her the whole damn time.
Oh yeah. My God, you're right. She probably was just felt sexually assaulted.
Yeah. She was like, I don't want to see those people.
Oh, that's man. Gonna be tough. Yeah, they had to divert the whole ship to pick her up from the reunion. They diverted the entire Enterprise to pick her ass.
You know what? That's a good
her...
point. That is a little weird.
Yeah, from her.
Did she leave early?
Worf had to take a shuttlecraft when he went to that.
Yeah, when he went to the Klingon.
Some kind of battle competition or
Bat-Leth
something.
Tournament.
Yeah, the battle.
And that did not turn out well for him.
It
that is a fucked up episode.
Troy just gets picked right up.
So, yeah.
But anyway, so it's unrelated. She didn't cause this. She didn't cause the problem for Data. His insistence on downloading the mission logs from the wacky probe or whatever that had crashed is what caused the problem.
Overloaded his positronic
yeah,
matrix.
Yeah, but so the thing about this part, this main, this main.
Well, first I think we should sort of set the premise, which is. The reason the reason it's taking so long is because they were delayed, what I'm assuming to be like 3 days or something. This all takes place over like 3 days. They were delayed to pick up Data or a few days. I'm not, because there was some kind of medical supplies they had to pick up or something.
That's right.
There was some, I don't know, from the Tuvok ship.
What's this place called? Like Barkon?
Oh, it's they were supposed to rendezvous with the Lexington to take medical supplies to the Tarenko colony.
Tarenko.
For a few days, I think. So that's, I think, we're to assume that all the events in this episode happened over the course of a few days. I'm guessing radiation acts pretty quickly, right? But isn't by then, I don't know, it's hard to recover from radiation, but this is future science.
Yeah,
so.
Presumably.
Okay.
But the cool part is that this is, fundamentally, it's a story about logic, you know, reasons, sort of the scientific method, and in taking the title to thine own self be true, Data has amnesia. He doesn't even remember the meaning of certain words, you know, which is peculiar.
Yeah, he doesn't remember radioactive. He remembers that he's supposed to have an appetite because that's what humans have. Yeah. He's like, I don't have an appetite. That's why I'm eating. He understands that he's supposed to feel hunger.
Yeah.
But he doesn't know what radioactive means.
So obviously.
He knows that wood contains thousands of compounds or whatever.
Yeah. And cellular matrices and things like that.
Yeah.
But it's really neat because obviously Data at his core, you take away his memory, but he's a reasoning machine. That's kind of his whole deal.
He is like the master scientist.
And even though obviously the setup is a little, you know, if you dig into it too much, it sort of doesn't make a lot of sense.
But yeah, but it doesn't matter.
But it's irrelevant because this is Star Trek, and that's the whole point. This is what I was mentioning in last week's episode about the Expanse and how brilliant the Expanse is. But the Expanse is realistic and hardcore, and it derives a lot of brilliance from that. But Star Trek, because it's willing to play a little bit and not tie itself in too much in terms of story dynamics and being a little bit unrealistic to get a story going, because the point of the story is it's like a moral tale. And it's highlighting the value of Data's inherent goodness and his desire to his ability to deduct things from evidence, you know, and that's a cool message. That's just a fun message to have in this type of episode.
Yeah, and it's hard to put across that message like so succinctly. That's a hard word to say. Succinctly, and so clearly, when you get bogged down with too many of these kind of unimportant sort of side details and things like that, it's kind of like, you know, when they make video games, right? And some people complain about how realistic certain aspects are, and you're just kind of like, you know. It's gotta be a game. It's gotta be fun.
Yeah.
It's gotta be fun. If you want to play simulations, there are simulations, and that's fun for you. But sometimes you just want, and this is, I'm not saying it makes the episode necessarily more or less fun. I'm just saying it gives it more of a moral, like focuses more on the moral message, which, as you were describing before about Star Trek, it's more important in a lot of ways, you know, because of the Expanse. That's what you said last episode.
Yeah, the stories can be more important broadly in a social sense, you know, not to be too highfalutin about it, but it's just that it's especially because this is a singular episode. Anybody could pop on this episode without knowing any of these characters and still get the whole breadth of the story. Like the whole impact of the story can be achieved, which is one of the advantages to both.
You can do this story and take out all the sci-fi elements and do it as a Western.
Sure.
It's one of those stories where
absolutely.
It fits, you could switch it around to any sort of genre.
Yeah.
It could be a weird sort of, you know, crime story, possibly, you know, anything. Yeah.
It is an advantage of the episodic style of storytelling. You know, there's advantages and disadvantages. But anybody could check this out. And I think most people would enjoy this story because it's a fun one. Probably, you know, I guess, it always depends. You know, a lot of times people say you want to introduce a friend or family member to Star Trek. You know, what are good episodes to do that? For some people, I think this would be a good episode to kind of lay out kind of like, here's the basic Star Trek story.
Yeah, and I found this episode, when I was watching it, I was surprised how easy it was to watch, meaning, and sometimes, I don't want to mean like, it's easy to watch, meaning it's like, it's that somehow has a negative connotation, something that's easy to digest, meaning
it's accessible.
It's accessible, right, and I think that's, you know, and that's not necessarily, that's not a bad thing. I found it just, it was, the time just kind of went by. I've seen this episode so many times. I've seen a lot of TNG so many times. I was like, okay, am I really going to feel like watching this again? And the episode just flew by, you know, because it's just really good.
And it's very well written. And I'll tell you what I was surprised by, the fucking wardrobe on this Garvin. Mm. Every fucking scene he had like a new costume and it was all ornate.
Yeah. Yeah.
Garvin, he was the town magistrate.
Yeah, it was very like Renaissance kind of.
Yeah, especially Riker at the end. I thought Crusher.
Riker, oh my God, go ahead.
I was like, Crusher looked like, it looked natural with Crusher. Riker looked like a clown or something.
Riker was rocking that shit.
He was.
That like tilted, like weird hoodie hat thing.
He looked absurd and ridiculous, but because it's Riker, it's amazing.
Yeah, it was. And he was standing kind of all like,
yes.
Standing all sexy.
Yeah, like a king.
Yeah, I like. Anyway, oh, but the by far for me the best character in this whole episode in terms of appearance and sort of attitude is because you have Garvin, you have his daughter Gia, who I thought the actress did an amazing job playing this inquisitive young woman, and who again she stayed towards the title Thine Own Self. She stayed true to whatever her internal things are. We don't know this girl, but we can derive from the plot and the characterization that this is she's a curious person and a good person. She wants to help people. She wants to help her father. Even when she's ill, she wants to help her father. She did a great job.
Yeah. And then the actor who played her was just, it was
really great.
Pulled it off. Really
well. The school teacher / medicine
Doctor,
lady or whatever.
Talor.
Brilliant.
In the Walton.
And I want to talk about her arc in a second. Cause I really like her character, but the best was the fucking blacksmith.
Yeah. Asshole motherfucker.
Who had a fucking Chicago style mustache.
That guy.
Scoran.
That guy's in a million different things.
He's in a million different things. I know him from Seinfeld.
Yeah, that's right.
He had a brief cameo.
He was a mechanic, and he was in Curb as a mechanic.
He was also at a brief appearance in Wayne's World. He was talking to Al Bundy.
Yeah.
And he was like, Al Bundy was like, oh, I know what you, he lost a job.
He's in a ton of stuff. He always has a Chicago accent.
Yeah.
Including in this.
Yeah.
Including this. And I don't know if anybody noticed, but he was wearing like this funny 20th century hat at one point that like was not, it was like.
Oh, I didn't even notice
that. This guy's from medieval Chicago or something.
Yeah. No, straight up. Because everyone else, not only the costuming, but like nobody else had fucking beards or mustaches. Yeah. And this dude, they were just like, we want to hire that actor. Yeah. We owe him a favor or something. He's like, I'm not shaving the mustache.
Yeah.
Mustache.
He also played a Klingon in Redemption.
Oh, that's cool.
One and two. He was Captain Larg.
Captain Larg. Fuck yeah.
Do Klingons have mustaches? They only seem to have.
I don't think he had a mustache in this one. Yeah.
Yeah. But they do. They'll have mustaches, just not Chicago style mustaches.
Yeah. Not that kind.
Yeah. Get the deep dish.
But it was like he was playing the same guy from Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm. But it was like he was just in Star Trek.
Get me my Batliff. Give me a hot dog and a Batliff.
I'm glad Patrick brought that up. I was going to bring that guy up.
Oh, that I just A-less? I could not stop staring. Of course, his voice was funny and his mannerisms, but the mustache was. So compared to all the other like stuff they did to make this quaint little village that again, you know, for it was a high budget show for what it was, but, and this was later on in this is 1994, but still, I mean, the sets are great. The costuming is great. I mean, you really believe you're in some weird ass little village with a bunch of backward ass people.
Yeah. I'll give you 20 Doraks for half the lot.
Agreed.
You're getting old. I said 15.
You know, like takes that like uranium and like pounds on it with a hammer.
Yeah. Like, well, that was interesting because he seemed to actually be the only knowledgeable one between him and Talor, who seemed like, okay. Right.
She was knowledgeable within the limits of whatever they had going on.
She still had the basic, even though she seemed like she was some kind of nonsense, not a charlatan, because she didn't seem like she was trying to fool anybody, but she seemed like she was full of shit, but she wasn't, in the sense that you could tell she still was looking for truth.
Yes.
Even though you could tell at times she was annoyed by Data, she was kind of annoyed by like how Data was like questioning her. She never expressed annoyance. You could just kind of see her in her face, but in the end, she was like, I want to look at all that data. You know, what can I look at your microscope? Can I do this? So she was willing
I took that to mean she wanted to see his robot penis.
She was the only one.
I want to examine all the data.
He's fully functional.
Yeah.
Fully functional.
No, I agree. What was great about that character was that it presents her as the quote, you know, the healer, you know, the knowledge or, you know, sort of the wizardy type person. And as you note, like, they didn't portray her as some sort of like goofy stereotypical witch doctor type person. They portrayed her as a real human being, in that they would have knowledge. Some of that knowledge would be correct, just straight up correct. Some of it would be correct, but maybe for reasons they don't understand, you know, like certain herbs or something being medicine. Some of it would be total nonsense, like the giants and the creatures and the Iceman and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But the point being is that she, as you noted, she clearly was not portrayed as some backward fool like some of the people in the village were. She differentiated herself as similar to Gia, in that she was curious and seemed to actually want to know, like you said. So that was really, really cool that they did that, and they didn't do the whole stereotypical like, oh, look at all these morons, you know?
Yeah. Gia, it seemed like Gia respected Data's knowledge. It seemed like Gia was like a little sick of Talor from time to time.
Oh, yeah.
And like, just like, well, who is this? It was funny.
She was haughty.
Yeah, she was haughty for sure. Talor says, she goes, the Iceman thing, she goes, current scientific methodology allows us to dismiss such ridiculous superstition and concentrate on scientific reality. He goes, what do you believe I am? You are an Iceman from the Valorian Mountains.
Nope, you are an Iceman.
Yeah. So, and it's characters like her, though, that I think sometimes people express that science is treated like a belief system. And of course, science by definition is not a religion. It's.
She even says something about like, that's something you'll lose faith in.
Yeah, she does. I remember that part. And, so the thing is science is by definition, it's not a religion, but I think some people sort of like get a little too confident in their assertions sometimes.
Yeah, which is it's a human enterprise, unfortunately, and subject to human foibles.
And that's the part that they can be, whether right or wrong, I mean, they can be absolutely correct by so many things, but once they start getting the attitude that they're just absolutely confident that they're the only right person. Maybe they're just used to being the only right person.
It's the ivory tower mentality. Mm-hmm. And it is what is, unfortunately, does turn some people off to the idea of, you know, the sort of the idea of investigating the universe and finding both practical answers and answers to some philosophical questions and things like, are we alone in the universe and stuff?
People just got to keep up the idea that it's like, I can be wrong about this.
And the thing is a proper scientist, and unfortunately I'm sure, you know, the proportion is not where we want it to be, but a proper scientist is happy the day they're proven wrong, because it means they're that much closer to getting to the truth. That's a good scientist. Now, you know, the people who are just after having a big name, selling books or selling scrolls in this context or whatever, or in her case, again, they didn't portray her like that, which was cool. They portrayed her as old school, given the culture she was born in. Mm-hmm. But and tell me what you think about this, right? In the course of the episode, by the end, we see a change in her. And it's not that she's changed her character. She's still being true to herself. She's still being true to her curiosity and her desire for the truth. She's just discovered through her interaction with Data a new way to look at it. He's shown her radioactive particles. He's made a microscope for her that she's keeping, presumably. Mm-hmm. She's now been affected by that. Is this an abrogation of the Prime Directive?
Right.
Because they tried not to do that, obviously. They wanted to get rid of the radioactive stuff. They ended up beaming Data away. They were wearing the costumes.
What are you going to do if your positronic brain gets messed
up? what are you going to do?
You're going to forget about the Prime Directive. It's going to go right out the window.
Well, yeah. Well, 100%. It's not like a willful. You're right. Yeah. It's not a willful.
Right. No, he had amnesia, so he didn't.
He had a bad case of amnesia.
Yeah, I mean, it all went from some probe that went kaput, right? So who made that probe? They're the ones who should get in trouble, right? Because they had to go out. I don't know. Yeah. Who gets in trouble for the Prime Directive? How do they place blame in a situation like this?
This is also.
I'm sure there's a round of finger pointing that follows.
Yeah. We won't get into this at this stage, right. but the grander debate about the Federation and how most of Star Trek, of course, looks at the Federation from the Federation's perspective and from Starfleet's perspective, and that they're the good guys. And even if there's mistakes here and there, it's all for the greater good. But another perspective could argue, why the fuck are you flinging all these probes around close to planets? Right. What are you
flinging
probes?
It's like they knew there were people down there, and they were like, oh yeah, Data will just sneak in there, and he'll pop back up again, and nobody will see him.
And we'll just leave him there for a few days.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, he's like, well, we got diverted. We have to tell Data at the last second we have to drop off medical supplies.
Like, how long does it take to beam down, grab a couple fucking bits and pieces?
We got to do this. Pick up Troy. Oh, Data, hey, what's going on?
But just like certain details can't bog us down to the truth, your question still remains of like, is that...
Functionally.
Functionally.
Violating.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see how you could argue it isn't. I mean, so there's a difference between handing somebody technology and teaching them technology, but she was handed a microscope. But the microscope,
teach a man to fish.
Teach
a lady to microscope. To build it.
So if you, precisely. He used her stuff to build it, so she could easily see right away. Oh, this is how you do this. It's not like you hand someone in.
He didn't hand her a tricorder and started going like
right. Right, precisely. So I don't know. It's a fuzzy line that you tickled the grayscale a little bit with that one.
Callback. Fair points.
So 100%
fair points. But on the other hand, she went from thinking, being 100% confident
it's
in the
true.
Fact that wood had rocks and water in it. The funny part is wood actually does have water in it. She was like, it's hard to see the water. And it was kind of like a bullshit cover up. But I'm sure Data was thinking like, yeah, it actually does have water in it. Although water is not an element.
I thought it was pretty creative how they came up with her whole sort of explanation for how things work. Of course, they gathered from the old four elements, like earth, wind, water, fire, except it was sky, water, fire, rock.
Yeah.
But the whole thing about it's like, well, the fire is deep inside and you need to like lure it out with more fire. Wait, where did that fire come from? You know, like, but no, I thought it was pretty creative that they built this whole sort of like fake
and
system that
smoke and you'll see smoke.
And it's a good example of early sort of proto scientific thinking in that
proto.
They had
proto Baggins.
They had enough knowledge to understand certain aspects of the world, but not necessarily understand it in the fundamental way of the actual processes, right? Mm-hmm. And I really thought, I agree with you, they did a great job of creating that sort of mythology that also, it makes sense. It sounds stupid if you know about modern organic chemistry, but it makes sense from their perspective, because why not? There's nothing going against it, right? They're at the point where if something goes against something, all right, maybe they'll revise it or whatever, right? That's the impression you get. But it makes sense. It's similar to how the miasma theory of disease, before they discovered germs, there was a theory that bad odors,
right?
You know, bad smells, the miasma, the gases
usually came out of a swamp or some sort
of that those were
funkiness.
Those transmitted illness. And the thing is,
and swamp ass, right?
No, that's I think
that's where the swamp ass comes from.
Yes, my swamp ass causes your
comes from my asthma.
Wow. That was awesome.
Well, quick wit. But the thing about the miasma theory, right, was that it kind of worked in the sense it's totally wrong. It's not how the diseases were transmitted, but it did get people to start like not living right next to gross, fetid piles of grossness, clean up the sewers a little bit, drink clean water, not drink dirt, you know, because they associated bad smells with disease. And that, now we know.
And that will cut down on, say, bugs, mosquitoes, that kind of stuff that might be transmitting these diseases that you think are transmitted by poisonous gas, but they're actually transmitted by insects and germs and stuff.
I just had a thought about a parody song about the Ninja Turtles, but it would be like, we didn't start the fire. It would be like, we are the Ninja Turtles. We are the Ninja. Because that line where he's like, trouble in the sewers. He'd be like, trouble in the sewers. We are the Ninja Turtles.
All right. That's it.
Okay. I had to say that before I forgot it. Because when you get a tune in your head, you think you know it forever. And then it just falls out of your head like a dream.
Do you have any other lines?
I just came up with
can
this
you come right up with something related to Krang?
Krang. Gonna Krang. What else do I have to say?
I thought you were starting to rap. I thought you were like switching to a new.
No, that was.
I thought that was a new song.
Yeah, no. I thought it was a new song.
Too. Oh, a new song. No, I was gonna do more of a. Okay, I'm sorry. I derailed that. That was purely selfish. We were talking about the sewers, bad smells.
We're talking about the idea
trouble in the sewers.
That we have a character here who is not some moron. She's working with whatever the paradigm of scientific knowledge that they have, but that she has in fact, you know, learned something through her interaction with Data. And you could argue Gia has as well, but not exactly the same as this particular character, because she was already primed for knowledge gathering. She's a learned person.
She's some kind of alchemist. Yeah.
Yeah. And just like the real alchemists, you know, They
were trying to do science.
And they were doing, they actually ended up doing lots of science.
And that's the thing about her kind
of, that's where science basically comes from.
And as ridiculous as her assertions were, like, those people, you need those thoughts to get to, that's what science is. You need thoughts similar to that in order to find the sort of like the truth, right?
Yeah. And plus she's given them the herb that gets rid of the headache and it works.
Yeah, it works. So, you know, it's like aspirin. She gets them the space aspirin.
magic worked like part of the time. That's why they kept doing it, because it worked, it had results.
And you just keep doing it, and then when it stops working, you're like, wait a minute, why didn't it work that time?
Wait a minute, what's up with that?
You
just came up with a reason.
And some weak ass magic you're giving me here.
So yeah, she did her thing and
did a little dance. She kind of flirted around with Data a little bit.
Yeah. She gave she gave two faces that were the same. At one point, midway through the episode, when she was explaining how water hides in wood or whatever, and Data was like, "Excuse me," you know, and she gave this look, kind of like, but then she was really nice. She was like, "Yes, Data, what is it?" Or "Yes, Jaden, rather."
Jaden. Can you imagine? Okay, just side note, sidebar. It's funny that in 1994, Jaden was the name and medieval race of aliens gives to a robot in a sci-fi show. And nowadays, it's just like the world is littered with fucking all these young little Jadens.
Yeah. Jadens, Star Trek. Garvin wanted to call him Mr. Radioactive.
I know. That was hilarious. I like that.
Yeah.
I like Garvin in general. Yeah.
So she gave him this look kind of like, and at the very end, when Data got killed, by the way, Scorbin or whatever, that was pretty brutal move. Fucking spear some motherfucker in the back.
Yeah.
That dude was.
He got shocked.
He was not. He was no faker. He was.
No, he was like, he was all rocking.
He was from Chicago.
Yeah, it's from Chicago. So she gave a similar look to them at the end when she saw Data. She was disgusted that time. It's kind of like how she was like kind of like annoyed with Data.
Yeah.
But it was weird though, because she looked at them, but then she never said anything. It seems like she would have said a line, but it sort of, the scene ended with her just kind of like looking like, it wasn't really anguish. It was just kind
of
like,
I took it to that final clicking in her brain of almost, I mean, not to over-aggrandize this fairly straightforward and simple story, but it's similar to 2001 A Space Odyssey, you know, when you touch the, you know, every time the humans touch the monolith, there's like something clicks monolith in their brain and they move to the next stage of evolution. Mm-hmm. I really kind of took it as a mini version of that she was looking on at this crowd, this mob of people who had just murdered this guy. For no particularly good reason.
Yeah.
Right? And
it was like a moment of
it was clarity, a moment of clarity, right? Yeah. So
to back to your point about if this broke the prime directive. So once again, I guess this could always, like many things, could be brought back to a level of abstraction, because if you simply say it's someone from another village, right? You can have someone from another village come along and catalyze more knowledge without handing it to you. So he, so that's just the interacting with people or life or whatever you want to call it, species, lives, things. And but but this Prime Directive is very clear. We're going to stop this level of abstraction at planets. So that's very clear about that. But on some level, it is, even though it's breaking it, it's still, you could say it's not such a big deal because it might as well just be some village that like figured this shit out before you did or whatever.
And the, you know, and there's going to be endless discussions throughout all time about the nature of the Prime Directive, both in terms of, as you suggested, who it actually enforces it, what are the decision-making things. And also, we've seen so many, not only, people tend to focus on how many times we've seen the Prime Directive broken, whether on purpose or by accident or just incidentally. But there's also the alternative version, which is, how far does the Federation go to actually protect the concept of the Prime Directive? Because as far as I know, right, there's the, if the Klingons show up and start fucking around with somebody, I mean, we haven't seen that I can recall too many examples of the Federation coming and being like, no, Klingons, we're going to prevent you. We're going to have like an armada protect this planet and prevent you from landing here.
This would be a good idea for a podcast, but it would be like, it would take a good amount of research to do that.
Yeah, we'd have to watch all of Star Trek.
Yeah, exactly.
Or rely on our kind listeners to send us emails at feedback@itsgotstartrek.com.
Feedback.
With suggestions for all that. Yeah, so, I mean, okay, how about Brent Spiner, right? Brent Spiner, he's always great as Data.
He looked good in those tights.
Okay, so something I never really caught on to before, but particularly in the final scene where, you know, he's back on the Enterprise, did they put a different wig on him or something? Because his hair is like reddish.
There was something shiny about that cushion. That cushion had a weird shiny rainbow
cushion?
Kind of, the cushion in sick bay where he was on that. Sick baby.
I'm gonna have to watch that again.
His hair is kind of hair is all fluffy and puffy. It's a different hairstyle. It's not the usual Data slick back hairstyle. Now, granted, he's been through a lot and walked over 200 bleemlarbs, which I think is 100 kilometers.
Yeah,
you're right.
He had some kind of funny measurement.
Yeah, the probe landed over 100 kilometers away, according to Crusher, I think. And then when he landed,
Galvatron.
Garvin goes like, you came from the mountains. That's over 200 Seltons away.
Seltons.
Yeah. So yeah. Twice Seltons. As much. How much is a mile? It's like 1.5 kilometers or something.
1.6.
So it's just over. So it's a little over a mile.
I'm sorry. I think a kilometer is 0.6 of a mile. So yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's 1,000 meters, which is approximately 3,000 feet, and a mile is 5,000 something something feet.
I like that we're taking notes and looking up all this
other
stuff,
know.
But
we're not
bothering to look up this very simple conversion.
Yeah, I don't know the metric
system.
Let's
discuss this.
This podcast is done in America, and we don't use the metric system.
Okay, right. So, but we can confidently say that a Seltan is a little bit more than a mile.
Yeah.
Because the Seltan is twice as much as
a
kilometer.
It seems like a little bit, yeah. A little bit more.
A little bit.
What's smaller than a Seltan? A Briton?
I don't know. You know, like a Brit? Someone from Brittany?
I don't know, like
someone from Britannica?
Celtic?
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 It's a Kelton.
It's a Kelton.
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 I am Kelton. Welcome to your planet. Welcome.
I am Kelton.
I am Kelton.
We are from Barkon 4, but we are Keltons.
We are both Kelton.
They're from Barkon 4.
Yeah, that's right.
Barkon. Now, do you think Barkon... Okay.
Barkon.
It's seventh season. It's the seventh season. Do you think they just got tired of coming up with blankets like Barkon?
Barkon.
Hey, what should we call this planet of medieval people? I don't know. Barkon.
And they measure things in Seltons.
Seltons.
It always comes out better when you don't.
And they
try
have 20
Blargnargs.
And they have 20 Dorax.
Dorax.
Because like the planets on like the new Picard show are like, you know, they sort of sound like something you may have heard before, but they're a different name. It's like, you know, they weren't trying real hard to come up with something wacky. They're just like, we're just going to call it blah, blah.
Yeah, some sort of like Greek names.
Yeah, a little bit Greek. Scoron. Change the letter around, you know.
When that anvil falls and Data picks it up and puts it back down,
yeah,
that anvil's wiggling around a little too much to be a heavy ass.
It's
when
funny.
He puts it down, yeah, it's all like wobble, wobble.
Whenever
wobble.
Somebody does something unexpected and picks up something like that's super heavy, there's always somebody that's like, just put it down. Yeah. It's like, they don't know what to do. Yeah. It's like, well, he can pick it up. Why does he have to put it down again? It's like, I don't know what's going on. So you better just put that back down again.
Just put it down. We're all good. Yeah. It was cool that, the first time he expressed his strength was with that radioactive, suitcase thing. And he held it like it was nothing. And then Garvin took it.
Yeah,
and it wasn't so heavy that he couldn't lift it. It was just much heavier than he expected. And then they let it up later with the anvil thing. So, and then he puts the anvil and it's all wiggling like it's probably weighs a pound.
He was like,
but when he puts it back down, it's fine.
He was talking to that dude like, you know, get like just be calm, you know, like we're gonna see what we can do. And then like Data like lifts that shit up.
Well, he was strong because his people probably all have great strength because it allows them to fight off the ferocious creatures that live in the Valorian Mountains.
Yeah, Iceman.
Yeah, he's talking about hearsay.
Well, and again, what the writers have done there is provide an example of a type of reasoning, as he describes it, you know, reasoning by analogy, that was prevalent in the pre-science period. And it's what a lot of folks don't understand, because a lot of people still do this today, because it's a perfectly rational, reasonable thing to do in many circumstances, right? But it's not scientific. It's not the scientific method. So sometimes people confuse that. They confuse coming up with a clever set of, like as Spock says in The Undiscovered Country, you know, developing a theory that happens to fit the facts. That's nothing. That's useful as a jumping off point to be like, all right, now let's go test this. Let's go figure out if this is right. And then along the way, we'll figure out where we're wrong and revise it. That's the second step you need, right? But too many people, certainly back in the day, in the type of community that this is depicting, that was the way of thinking, is this makes sense. This is what we're going to say. We're just going to assume it's right. There be monsters.
Well, so when Garvin was sick, sort of along that line, she goes, you feel slightly warm. Some fresh air and a brisk walk will do you good. Like, she says that as if she gave some amazing medical advice. And she says it so confidently and just kind of like, so she says all this, she has this air about her where she has to sort of augment what she says with sort of the attitude with which she speaks it. She tries to be very authoritative about that kind of stuff. The one scene I wanted to bring up is when Gia starts talking about her mom that died, and she says, father says she went to a beautiful place where everything is peaceful, where everyone loves each other, and no one ever gets sick. And then she goes, do you think there's really a place like that? And then Data goes, yes, I do. Now, why did he say that? Is the Enterprise is not... I mean, first of all,
the Enterprise is heaven. Everyone on the Enterprise is dead.
I mean...
It's canon.
It's... What?
They're all ghosts.
Well,
this proves it.
I'm just saying. Oh my gosh, it's
a fucking ghost ship.
That's a spurious correlation you're making.
Beep, beep, beep. You know what I say to that? Beep. You know what my academic response to that is?
So first of all, dude, people must get sick on the Enterprise. Not everyone loves each other. Everything is not peaceful. Yeah. So what did he mean? What was the point of that line?
No, again, it's a story, but also from Data's perspective, he probably does feel like that's the perfect place for him, right?
Yeah, I don't know that. It would seem like he was trying to say more than it really did.
It's heavy-handed. A lot of the stuff in this episode is heavy-handed. I think most of it plays okay. Yeah. I mean, the blacksmith guy straight up says, go back to where you came from.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, hammering on the head. You know, there's a racial, prejudicial component to this.
So, yeah, we can relate that to current events, right? Because he calls him Iceman even later on before they hit him in the face.
Yeah.
Scorin is like, he follows through with what he says he's gonna do. He's no wimp about it. But he calls him Iceman, even though at this point it's established it's not his name. So he refers to him as, you are this kind of person, you are this person.
He's categorizing him.
Yes, he's categorizing him as not us. You don't get a name.
You don't get the honor of a name.
We can draw parallels to that. He also tells him to go back to where he came from. I don't care where that is. I don't care how you can possibly help us. I'm not interested in the truth. I'm interested in getting rid of you, because that's the easiest thing for my brain to handle.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, what year was this? In the early 90s?
94.
94.
Yeah. So, I believe 93, 94.
So that's a common theme that's stuck around to this day. So,
yeah. it's worse in some ways.
Yes.
You know.
Twice in the episode, closed captioning described the crowd of people walking away as angry muttering. Yeah, angry muttering. So
I know about that.
But
I do that all the time.
Yeah.
So that last scene was I'm not the last scene, but the last scene with Data in the village when they kill him, basically, mm-hmm. or think they kill him, right? Shortly thereafter, you know, that's pretty intense, as you noted, horrible mob and all that. It's interesting they buried him, right? So we can, granted, of course, they were limited to what, 43 minutes of story time at this stage, I think, right? So obviously there's some shortcuts, but you can still infer something, right? They buried him. They didn't have to do that. For the nature of the story, there was nothing like that made it that had to be that. They could have just been like, we buried the fragments out in the woods. They could have buried the Data out in the woods.
Yeah.
You know, they buried him. So that you can infer from that some faction sufficient enough, powerful enough, Garvin, Gia, the healer woman, what's her name?
Talor.
At a minimum, but quite probably others were convinced that not only do we bury this guy, we got to bury him in like the town fucking square, yeah. basically.
Yeah.
It almost is like a monument. So even right. though not much time, of course, this is super compressed because Troy manages to pass all these incredibly difficult tests
yeah.
in the course of a couple days. And Data is buried and a stone monument with an engraved plaque is erected, you know, in the town square. And you can sense that people are somehow memorializing him, that they're now feeling well. Mm. They got well really quick from the well water.
From the well water.
Well.
That he spiked, and like right before they killed him, they had to have seen him spike that, right?
Yeah, they weren't smart enough to figure out what he was. Yeah.
We'll soon.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
I agree.
I shouldn't even point it out because I'm just like, hey guys, I noticed things, you know?
And so Barkon 4 probably just gets forgotten about the Federation.
I think they should do
like 100 so years.
In season one of the Riker TV show, they should like fly back there.
Yeah.
They should do a Riker TV show, and he should fly back to there. And,
Riker's intergalactic pizza kitchen.
That'd be awesome if he started a food starship.
Just like a food starship.
Food starship.
And be like, and like he just have his make rounds.
Like sidle up next to it.
That would be like in chic, in vogue.
In chic.
I'd say words.
Sometimes.
To have like a spaceship that just makes, they don't replicate any of their food. They make it. It's like,
he's making it. Yeah, he's making it. He built the pizza oven on the ship.
It would be like the Star Trek version of the Chinese food delivery man in The Fifth Element who goes around in that little, possibly racist Chinese junk selling food, you know, window to window.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Seems to be Riker.
Right. Yeah.
After
you have been fired.
Troy goes,
that's a quote from The Fifth Element.
When she uses some techno babble when she's taking the test, she goes, switch the EM power converter to the lateral, use the Neodyne relay or whatever. And then Geordi's like, you can't use the Neodyne relay because it's fucked up or something. And then everything blows up. And Riker just strolls up and goes, congratulations, you just destroyed the Enterprise.
Yeah, right.
What a dick thing to say to somebody who just failed the test. It's like, it's not like she tried to do it, you know? And he follows it up like, it's okay, you passed everything else. But she was unusually petulant. You don't see Troy petulant too often, except around her mother.
And right. I think...
Sometimes with Riker.
You know what? That's an excellent observation, because I think that... Because earlier you made the point that Troy is weirdly in a position where she's, in order to gain more authority, she is temporarily placing herself in a position of less authority vis-a-vis Commander Riker. And you just mentioned that she know, because I was thinking the same thing, that you don't usually see her this petulant, but I hadn't made the connection to her mom, who is another person who has a certain level of power over her, even though Troy is a very clearly independent person and does her own thing. She does have this difficult, tricky relationship with her mother. And that is a really interesting comparison, that it's that petulance is similar to how she often is acting around her mom.
So when that power reversal when there's a power reversal in that sense, and she sort of feels a little helpless, she kind of reverts a little bit, you know?
Back yeah. Then.
So picking apart the pick aparter is what you do when you analyze the psychologist.
Yeah. Trick the trickster.
Yeah.
All right. So I think the last thing I was going to observe is that Brent Spiner has to have, or once upon a time, had to have some very good abs because he's always doing that Data sitting up straight move.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know. That is difficult. I think that's a tricky thing to do. I've tried to do it before. Not recently, admittedly. But the whole like lying flat and just going, yuck, just that part going up.
Yeah. It's not easy.
It's not easy.
Yeah. Man. And I said, like I was saying before, when he was in that weird, that seems like it's from, first of all, it seemed like it was from an old horror movie when he was in the cloak and the hood and he was talking to Gia and he was like, don't look at me. So that seemed like,
I don't want to scare you.
Yeah. It seemed like it was pulled from something. But then later when he's going to the town square at night, you see from the backside, he's rocking those tights, you know? So I think he was much more fit than I think I gave him credit for.
Oh yeah.
You know, so yeah,
he's fully functional.
He's fully functional to the max, and so is Brent Spiner. But at the end, I think it's also effective when they talk to Gia, and it's more effective for Gia, even though Data didn't really remember. Even if he did, it's more effective for Gia to have it be the character of the daughter to explain to them the effect that he had on the town, as opposed to if he had remembered and later on was like, well, I did this and this and this. Like, you know, it's Data, so you know he's not lying, but it just doesn't have that same effect.
And you know what? I think it's a very interesting decision to have him not remember any of the events. I mean, what do you think about that? Because it is unusual for Data to come, not, you know, normally in Star Trek, everything gets recovered and not obviously not always.
Data is usually the one that remembers stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what about that. Yeah. I don't know what the purpose was kind of him not remembering that.
I've been trying to think if, you know, which way it made more sense. I will say, even if this was the only reason they did it, that if they did it for the sake of being able to have that really sort of cute interaction them, you know, I appear to have had an interesting time or something. And then Troy, I think it was Crusher who was all like, and you became a very important friend to a young girl.
Yeah. Riker goes, apparently you saved an entire village from radiation poisoning. You know, I wish that's what people said to me after I had a blackout. it's usually a much different story.
It's like, Dan, you caused radiation poisoning.
Yeah, I don't know.
All across campus.
Dan, oh man, are people mad at me?
Dan, you took all the mercury out of all the thermostats and just smeared it all over.
Oh man. Are you mad?
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's a good point. That's funny. That's hilarious. Anyway, so I think great episode. I think it's a good introductory episode for people. I think it's a great episode to go back and watch if you hadn't seen it in a while, if you're just jonesing for some Trek. It's got a strong message about how kind of science is awesome, but with the Troy part, it's also, there's the humanistic element of it. And of course, with Data, even though he's using science and deduction and all that, he's not doing it for any other reason than to help those people, right? And that's cool, you know, that there's also a humanistic element to that part, not to use the racist term humanistic, as we discussed on our previous podcast about
beingistic, inalienable rights. I don't think I mean it in a good way when I say this is a very accessible episode. Only in a good way do I mean that, because I don't mean that in like kind of like, oh, it's too accessible.
It's not dumbed down.
It's not. Yeah, right. I think it's a solid, like, accessible with a great message, and it's really entertaining. I just think it like flies by.
Really cool costumes and a cool Chicago style mustache.
Yep, it's Garan.
All right. Any other thoughts on this episode, or shall we wrap it up?
I think that about does it for me.
Yeah,
I've said all the things I need to say.
I think I've said all the things, too.
You're saying all sorts of things?
Yeah.
Johnny Notes.
Data has clammy skin. I thought clammy... Why would he have clammy skin?
I don't know. I was thrown off a little bit by that, too.
It seems like it would be a normal temperature, at least the temperature like that a computer would put on.
Yeah. He didn't eat enough meat, butter, and cheese.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Remarkable set of teeth. And a fantastic penis.
fully functional
fantastic penis. All right, cool. Well, we will be back next week with something. We don't know yet what, because we're in troubled times out here. Mm-hmm. So you never know what's going to happen. But you can find out what next week's episode is going to be about by going on to...
That's what's funny. It's like, we don't know what's going to happen around those troubled times, but you can find out next week when we're not dead yet.
Yeah, presuming we're still alive.
On the next episode of It's Got Life.
It's got supplies for the... post-apocalyptic wasteland.
It's got toilet paper and alcohol.
It's got weekly tips on how to keep the roving hordes at bay.
Well, now apparently TP is out of fashion. Now it's hair dye is like the thing that people are low on, apparently. That's the newest thing that people need and don't have.
Is it because I couldn't find enough artisanal bread.
Mm. Yeah, no, the artisanal bread is difficult. But my problem was is I went to go buy some artisanal bread, and I'm trying not to touch all the bread, but I'm flummoxed because I'm like, how do I need to grasp and sniff the bread.
I got
to
feel
to determine which loaf is the one to get.
This one's way too squishy.
It's fucked up.
We should be wearing gloves more so than masks.
Yeah, but the gloves are, that's a mess. The gloves are going to get dirty themselves.
Well, the gloves are going to get dirty, but like everyone wears the gloves, then you won't get the dirt from outside.
But if you wear gloves, you got to change your gloves all the time.
And you got to take the gloves off the right way like the doctors by slipping your fingers under, because otherwise you just end up taking all the dirt from the gloves like gets on you.
Yeah, we'll just do it the right way then.
Yeah, well, I know. Everyone, look that up on the internet.
I mean, if I wear gloves, it's not going to save you, but presumably if I wear it right, it would save me.
Y'all wearing your condoms? Because that's the other thing you can do. Just wear a condom all day long.
It's way up there. It's way up there.
The environment of an operating room.
Yes, operating room. Exactly.
There's no way to simulate that sort of
cleanliness. It's not going to be that sterile, but just some rubber gloves probably... I mean, I don't know. What do I don't know shit. I just imagine
just wash your hands and don't breathe on people.
Wash your hands.
I just imagine rubber gloves would be more useful than a mask, but a mask is definitely much more feasible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wear like a beekeeper's outfit.
What about
a beak?
God damn it.
Beekeeper.
She's a beekeeper. A beekeeper? A beekeeper. I have a PhD in drums. All right. Toast of London. Go check out that show. This is the recommendation.
We're plugging all kinds of shows.
Recommendation.
On this show.
Yeah. Since we don't have advertisers yet, because we decline to have any advertisers that we don't use, that are for products that we don't use.
Yeah.
And we don't use any, and none of the products we use want to advertise
with
us.
Capitalism.
Yeah, for real. Except if you're going to give us money.
Give us money.
In which case, find a way. Life finds a way. Money finds a way.
Find Jurassic Park.
Into our, yes, into our castle. The Fifth Element, Toast of London, Jurassic Park.
Jim Varney.
The Ernest movies, of which there are at least 9. I'm sure they're accessible somehow on the internet.
They're very accessible.
They're probably just on YouTube, honestly. I love how so many movies are just on YouTube. And I never watch them on YouTube because I feel guilty about it. But I don't know. There's something
you can watch them.
Yeah, I'm not talking about paid YouTube. I'm talking about like just somebody who's just like, yeah, here's the movie.
Somebody held up a camera to their TV. Put it on YouTube.
Those are the best ones. All right. So next week, on the condition that we are still alive and still able to broadcast, and that the event has not happened yet, then that Mitchell and Webb look. Never mind. So next week,
Mitchell and Webb look.
We're gonna talk about something Star Trek related, of some sort. You'll find out, and the way to find out is to follow us.
Some sort? Would it be a bubble sort?
To find
a boolean sort. Is that a? I don't think that's a sort.
Boolean logic.
Boolean logic.
Boolean logic.
They know boolean cues.
Oh, like a boolean.
Valdez nuts.
Ah, spelled D-E-E-Z. Sorry, I totally derailed that. That was my fault.
No, it's quite all right. So, if you want to find out what the fuck we're going to be talking about next week, you can find out by following us on Dan.
On Dan at feedback.com.
Back. All right.
YouTube.
Okay, no, but what's the name?
It's got Star Trek.
Yeah, but what do you put? What's the symbol in front of the name? This is what the kids are used to. This is how kids are used to hearing
Hashtag It's Got Star Trek.
No, not fucking hashtag.
Yes, there you go. At It's Got Star Trek.
There you go. At It's Got Star Trek on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Those are the... Those are the key places that you can find us. You can try to find us other places. It's probably some weird bootleg shit. Some like weird sub fans.
That'd be weird.
Yeah.
We should give our names. We should start giving our names because so people can know who we are.
But if people know who we are, then they'll fucking know who we are.
No,
man.
Well, what? That, huh?
Because so, that comment recently about like that guy that just couldn't finish a sentence.
Yeah.
That was, he was talking about Dan.
Yeah, I'm Dan.
I am Jesse.
I'm Patrick.
See, it's our fault for not, so people don't know.
Oh, yeah, I know. We don't go out of our way to be all like, hey, we should do a whole episode where we describe ourselves
what
and our entire
our
background in Star Trek. It'll be the least listened to episode. It could be a bonus episode.
Let's just associate the sound with the name. So this is what Dan sounds like.
When I was 9, Star Trek The Next Generation premiered.
Who is that? Who said that?
Nobody.
Who just said that? And you were about to do a Casey Kasem sign-off thing before, and I interrupted you.
My name's Dan.
No, you can't do
my
that.
My name's Dan, and no. This is...
My name's Patrick.
No, why are you guys doing... Oh, man. Are you serious?
We're deadly serious.
Oh,
okay.
I'm Dan.
Okay, I'm Dan.
No, fuck.
This is like Spartacus. We're trying to help you.
Okay, right. I get it.
You get it. We'll do another... Okay, if you guys... If you give any... 3 or 4 fucks which ones we are.
I don't care.
No. We'll make it. Maybe that's what we'll fucking do next week.
I've
moved on. I don't care anymore.
I sound like this.
I don't care.
You can be all like, oh, Patrick. Oh, this is Patrick. And my comment is this. We could do it that way. We could
for
have
everything
a,
we say.
Dan's the guy that sounds like this. Yeah. He talks like this.
God
says,
damn
why
it.
Can't I finish a sentence?
Okay, that's pretty close.
It's Got Star Trek. No, God damn it. At It's Got Star Trek is the social media business. www.itsgotstartrek.com for the website. Feedback at It's Got Star Trek for mail.
Doble bang.
Leave reviews and comments and all sorts of places and do all that normal podcasty stuff because you like us and that'd be nice. Join the rest of your friends.
I'm Patrick and I'm Jesse. Where's Dan? I don't know.
Be like our good friend at Gibberkit. At Gibberkit, who's very kind and wonderful person who treats us very well. Join him, follow him. And if you follow him, he retweets our stuff. So then you can, don't even have to follow us. You can just follow him. His tweets, his feed's way more interesting than the It's Got Star Trek feed, which is purely promotional and retweets things from TrekCore.com periodically. But otherwise, so we hope you enjoyed the show. We look forward to talking with you next week. Again, presuming everything remains copacetic and everyone's alive. And with that, I will say goodnight. My name is Patrick.
My name is Jesse.
My name is Patrick and Jesse.
There it is. Have a good evening, everyone.
Let's see. Heartbeat sounds a little odd, but seems very regular. Skin feels clammy. But you say you feel fine?
That is correct.
No headaches, palpitations, sluggishness, indigestion?
No. But I cannot have indigestion since I have not eaten.
Ah! Malnutrition. You should try to eat something that will build your strength and return your vitality. Lots of meat, butter, cheese. That should be a start.
What about his eyes and his skin? They're so odd.
Quite so. Quite so. I'm sure my grandmother would have called our friend here a demon or a spirit or some sort of monster. But current scientific methodology allows us to dismiss such ridiculous superstitions and concentrate on scientific reality.
Then what do you believe I am?
You are an ice man.
Ice man?
Yes, you probably come from a race of people who lived in the snow and the ice of the Valorian Mountains. Your skin and eye coloration are a result of prolonged exposure to harsh winter conditions.
Then I am not ill.
Well, aside from your memory loss, you do not seem to have any symptoms of any illness that I am familiar with. No, you are an ice man.